Sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Sentientam jade wadang. At the bottom of the pink sheet, on the first side, we'll say Green Tara's mantra and Chenrezig's mantra. We'll do Green Tara 7 times and Chenrezig 8. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re So Ha. 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 Om Mani Padme Hum, 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 Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. So the children can now go to their classes.
So we'll start out doing prostrations together. Those of you who want to do this, practice. There's always new people here on Sunday, so I'll say if you've heard this before, but prostrations are something that's sort of a traditional thing that we do here. It's a way of paying respect for the teachings and for the teachers and so forth, but it's also for our own benefit. It's an antidote to arrogance and pride. It helps to purify the negative karmas of our body, speech, and mind if we do it mindfully. So it's a great way to start the teachings because it sort of gets our mind in the right place. So we'll do three together, and we'll do this mantra. There's a mantra that many of you know. Stop at 11:40, but it's 5:38, so we'll be here a while. I think I better use a different clock. So we'll start out doing a couple of minutes of mindfulness meditation. I guess I was taught a lot of these different practices. If you're new to Kadampa Center, new to meditation, probably the main thing you need to do is bring your attention to your breath. We'll do a few minutes of this practice and then a little guided meditation to set the motivation. That's really important. So sit up straight if you're in a chair. You don't want to be necessarily leaning back, but you know you want your spine like stack of coins, you know, your vertebrae sitting upright, kind of like you have a little, if there was a hook at the top of your head or a little loop and the rope going up to the ceiling, it would just pull you straight up. That's really important in meditation to keep your mind alert. And you want your shoulders sort of back and down, your chest a little bit open. There are different ways to put your hands, but just for, you can put your hands in your lap, it's fine. It's whatever's comfortable. Your feet flat on the floor. Just bring your attention to the flow of the breath. For some of you, that may just be following the whole process of breathing. For others, you're paying attention to the sensation of the breath at the tip of the nose. And maybe some other people, the rising and falling of the abdomen. Whatever works for you, you want to focus on that. And when thoughts intrude, as they will, simply notice. If you've been taken away by a thought, you bring your mind back to the breath. understand how the mind works from the Buddhist perspective. It's so important that we set our motivation from the very get-go, that we have the most auspicious, most powerful motivation. And we're tapping into something that's part of our basic nature, but it's not instinctive for us in some ways. And that's that we would do for others what we wouldn't even think of doing for ourselves. So we're going to do a meditation, guided meditation, to develop this awakening mind called bodhicitta, where we set our aim at supreme enlightenment, which is a state of mind where there's no suffering, there's only wisdom and compassion and all the qualities of an enlightened being, all the qualities that we innately have already, but fully developed. So we set our sights at supreme enlightenment in order to be able to help others, in order to be a perfect guide, a perfect helper, a perfect to know exactly what to say and do in every situation to further others' growth and evolution toward their own state of enlightenment. So that's not where we go ordinarily when we think of doing spiritual practice or any activity. So kind of a quick way to get there that I find helpful is to start out by thinking of the equality of self and others, that we're all exactly the same in wanting happiness and not wanting to suffer. So we're all exactly the same in wanting happiness and not wanting to suffer. The Dalai Lama, he says when he does this particular meditation, sometimes he envisions, I think he said like a fence, and he's on one side and all of the sentient beings are on the other. And he thinks, you know, like, whose happiness is more important, the happiness of others or the happiness of me? And instinctively we think, well, my happiness is most important. But others are really infinite beings, aren't they? Countless others. So at least others' happiness is as important as mine. So what we're trying to develop here is this notion that we all are equal in wanting happiness and not wanting to suffer. Something very crucial that we can know about everybody we meet today, everybody in this room. We all have that same instinct. And then we turn on to the cause of all suffering, of all of the pain and misery, according to the laws of causality. What goes around comes around. The cause of every bit of suffering, not only ours but every other living being in samsara, in this whole universe, the single demonic force behind all the suffering is the self-cherishing, selfish mind. It thinks I'm the most important one, which immediately puts us in conflict with everybody else because we all have the same thought. I am the most important one. So that selfishness that we think protects us is actually our worst enemy. Self-cherishing selfishness, because of killing and stealing, adultery, lying, slander, harsh, frivolous talk, greed, hatred, ignorance. All the 84,000 delusions come from one source, the self-cherishing selfish mind, the source of all suffering. And the cause of happiness is its opposite. It's just as self-cherishing selfishness has very kind of the energy is very kind of tight and constricted and dark. The mind that focuses out on cherishing others is the source of all happiness. For happiness, as long as I put this bumper sticker, it says, for happiness, cherish others. It's so easy. For happiness, cherish others. Not easy to do. And then there's a sort of a, at least meditatively or intellectually, we can do this next step. It's called exchanging self for others. And it's exchanging, imagining that we're exchanging the attitude of self-cherishing for the thought of cherishing others. So now we cherish others more than self. So everything we do is for others. Everything we do is for others. We eat to keep ourselves healthy for others. You know, we do our job for others. We drive carefully to protect ourselves and others. Whatever we do, we focus on doing it on for the benefit of others. As Lamanisha said one time, as much as I can, I dedicate my life to others. Exactly the same thing. And then there's the next step is this, sometimes it's called different things, but I like the supreme wish. It's sometimes called the supreme wish. It's the wish, it's kind of, it sounds a little crazy when you hear it. But it's this determination saying, I am personally responsible for the happiness of all living beings throughout all space and time. It is not somebody else's job, it's mine. I'm personally responsible for the happiness of the of everybody in this room. I'm personally responsible for the happiness of everybody in this community, every living being throughout all space and time. I am personally responsible for their happiness, to guide them from the state of suffering or confusion to supreme enlightenment. It sounds crazy. It is a little crazy, but it's the attitude that a bodhisattva has. It's so extraordinary because it's not based on some megalomania sort of egocentric perspective. It's not coming from that. It's coming from genuine love and compassion. I am responsible for leading all my kind mother sentient beings from their current state of confusion and suffering to supreme enlightenment. And then we realize we can't do it. We just don't have the tools yet to do it. We have the potential, but we don't have the tools. And so we realize that we have to perfect ourselves. We have to develop our mind. We have to eliminate our negativities and develop our qualities. We have some compassion, some wisdom, some power, some skillful means, knowing what to say and do to help others. We have these qualities of a Buddha. We already have them. We just need to grow them infinitely. And we can't eliminate our faults because every one of them is based on a simple, basic mistake. A misperception of who we really are. The taproot of all of our suffering is selfishness. And it's completely based on a mistake. So it is possible to grow these qualities and eliminate our faults. So, we set our aim on supreme enlightenment in order to benefit all living beings. Based on love and compassion. And then how do we get there? We practice. We practice. There's an amazing path called Alamram, the stages of the path that the Buddha laid out to take us from our present state of confusion all the way to the Supreme Enlightenment. It is right. It's what is taught at Kadampa Center. It's what we aim to do, is to give each other the tools we need to support our spiritual evolution. So with that motivation in mind, make some determination to create value for yourself this morning. Listen with an open mind. Work with what we talk about. See if you can create some value that will support you in your relationships with your family, your co-workers, and your community in the coming weeks. Okay, you can relax your attention.
Oops, time is up. So we have
some time to talk. The subject I wanted to talk about, to try to keep things a little simple this week. It's not simple, though, because it's not a subject that gets talked about much in Buddhism. It's called forgiveness. And this is the only book that I think you'll find in the Tibetan Buddhist, in our library or any place else that has the, you don't see the word forgiveness very often in Tibetan Buddhism. I wonder why. So some of you Dharma scholars out there, people who finished discovering Buddhism, tell me why you think that forgiveness is not talked about much in Tibetan Buddhism. I'm not saying a word. We're listening. I will say something in a minute. We could be here a while.
Karma.
Peter, say more. Say more about that.
Karma.
Okay.
I like short answers. I think, and I may not explain this very well, so you may have to clarify, but I'm sure you will. But karma in the sense that what comes around goes around. And so understanding that, that's one thing in my mind that I think of. And the second thing is one way that I try to overlook when somebody does a harmful action is, I think we're all in samsara, we're all suffering from our individual delusions. And when you kind of realize that, then it's kind of like, well, I've got to give that person space.
Mm-hmm.
So when I think of those two things, that helps me think about forgiveness.
Now, tell me more about karma. You said karma. So what does that have to do with forgiveness or not hearing the word forgiveness in Tibetan Buddhism?
Well, I could be wrong here, but I think of, again, what comes around goes around. So whatever I've put out there is going to come back to me. So if I was cruel to somebody, then I feel like it will more than likely come back to me. And the way to kind of neutralize that is for me to forgive that person, to be able to move past whatever it was. That's my simplistic way of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about past lives, if you believe in reincarnation, then you realize that there's probably a lot of stuff out there, a lot that you're reaping and sowing good things and bad things.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that when bad things happen, that's kind of how I frame them, is I frame them as to what I've done in my past lives as well as my current life. And I've seen it even in, I face it every day. So
Okay.
Am I going there?
Yeah, that's good. That's good. That's good. Sorry. Anybody else want to add to that or say more?
I don't know. I'm thinking about it. I read somewhere this one Buddhist writer, and he said, and I'm not sure if I'm going to get this right, but he said one of the reasons that you don't hear about forgiveness in Buddhism so much is because it's we're really more concerned about the act, the thing that got you there to start with. And so I think it has a lot to do with what Peter was talking about, like with karma. This is what I think, if I can say, you know. We may not have a word for it, but we understand it. And it's something that is something that comes natural for us, mm-hmm. or can come natural for us.
Right.
You know, and so I think it's something that is truly essential. Whether you call it forgiveness, which is really more of like a Christian term, or whether you call it letting go, you know, it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think just because the word wasn't expressed or articulated doesn't mean that it's, the act wasn't going on, the
right.
forgiveness. So I think it's just a matter of some words aren't used.
Kind of a semantic issue, you think?
It's a semantic issue, semantic. I think. Okay. Yeah, personally, yeah.
All right. Sandy, you had your hand?
I might get this wrong. I'm going to take it one step further, and kind of one of the ways that I try to think about it is it's forgiveness kind of puts, for me, the act that somebody else is responsible for what's happening. I'm going to forgive you for what you did to me. Instead of me taking the responsibility of the act, because am I going on the right path?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay. So it's taking the responsibility for what's going wrong rather than putting the responsibility on somebody else and then needing to forgive them
mm-hmm.
for what they've done to you.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It does. I'm gonna read a couple of things that I have dredged up just to kind of add to this conversation, because this has been in my sort of digging at me for years. I've tried to look at this issue, and I called Nick Rebusch, who's the Columbia Issue Wisdom Archives, longtime friend. He's the guy that started Kuakua Center, and so I called him up. On Friday or Thursday, and I said, Nick, what is it that we don't see the word forgiveness in Tibetan Buddhism? And so we had an interesting discussion, and this is an email that, and where we ended up, I'll just say where we ended up. There's one of the nuns named Sarah, who's visited here before. She's working on a book by Lama Zopa Rinpoche, called The Kindness of the Enemy. The Kindness of the Enemy. So we're going to get there. It sounds a little, you know, this is not easy stuff. And really, it gets back to karma. It gets back to the law of causality, that we are ultimately responsible. But this is what Nick says. He sent an email to Sarah. He said, Don Brown was just asking me about forgiveness. There's not much in the teachings about it. We talked about it being non-resentment, one of the 20 mental factors. So forgiveness or, non-resentment. So if you are holding a grudge or something like that, obviously that's not helpful. And about patience and not retaliating. In fact, about the teachings being forgiveness on steroids. That is, we don't just forgive, but in fact think that those that harm us, they are so kind. The kindness of the enemy. This is the Lama Zopa's book. So this sounds totally bizarre, doesn't it? The kindness of the enemy. So it made me think of the teachings you're looking at, because she's doing this book. And then she, Sarah writes back and says, Rinpoche talks about this in the context of six things to teach kids. So It is in a talk he gave at San Francisco in February. Very beautiful talk. Rinpoche doesn't talk about forgiveness. Doesn't just talk about forgiveness. He also talks about asking forgiveness from others when you cause them harm. It's very interesting. He's not just talking about forgiveness. He's saying, ask for forgiveness. If you've done harm to others, then apologize. Ask them to forgive you. These are just basic human qualities that Rinpoche identifies without categorizing them as mental factors. So, it's not in the teachings, but it's in the teachings, right? So, it's a very interesting subject. Then, I went online. This is this came from January 2007, and Rinpoche's advice for essential education forgiveness project. Because forgiveness is one of those 16 guidelines that we, you know, in the children's program. He looked at a DVD on forgiveness. This is what Rinpoche said: look at the DVD on forgiveness and discuss what is missing, what could be added. Write down the main points that Fred Lushkin, the guy who did this, about forgiveness. Anything that can help people, and then add on to that. We should make, this is Rinpoche talking to, you know, essential education. We should make our own DVD on forgiveness, presenting the whole subject just as the man has done. Add in different points that make, that people make, elaborate and make it deeper and better with more reasons. Someone who is a good speaker can present it. This is something that can be given to schools and other families to watch and to learn from. Blah, blah, blah. So, you know, it's here. And then His Holiness in this book, The Wisdom of Forgiveness, you know, the example of the book doesn't have a lot of meat in it, but it's mainly about the relationship of Victor Chan with His Holiness and how he's so amazed that His Holiness has no anger or resentment toward the Chinese, who basically came in to Tibet in 1959 and just kicked the Tibetans out, the Dalai Lama and you know, many, many hundreds of thousands of Tibetans left. And so he has every reason to hate him, right? I mean, the numbers vary, but 2 to 4 to 6 million Tibetans have been killed or tortured over the years. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on, but he says, you know, his basic attitude is, well, why would I do that? Why would I harm myself? Poison my mind with anger, you know. No, I don't harbor any ill will toward the Chinese at all. So that to us is incredulous. If somebody came into your home and abducted, this is really kind of a brutal example, but I have children. I mean, I cannot imagine if somebody took one of my children and killed that child, how I could ever forgive that person. I mean, it's just amazing how that. But Venerable Robina gives a great example. I know some of you have heard this before, but I'll say it again. She gives an example of, she had a prisoner that she visited in Kentucky, and he was talking about this man who was a Christian, but he brought his rosary to different men on death row. And the story goes that this man's daughter had been killed by a guy who was on death row. And so this guy just was eaten up for years and years with anger and resentment and just couldn't let it go. It caused him a lot of suffering. And even after the guy who had killed his daughter had died, like maybe a decade later, he still was angry, still was holding on to that anger and resentment. And then finally he just realized, I mean, as a Christian, I think what Robina, as I recollect what she said, was he said, well, if Jesus can or God can forgive him, then so can I. And so at some point, this person was able to let go. To let literally let go of their anger and resentment. So that's
forgiveness, isn't it? That's how we're using it in this context. And not only did he let go, but then he started ministering to people on death row, giving these guys on death row his daughter's rosary. And he would go and counsel them and stuff like that. Just amazing. Going from being so angry to being able to actually flip it over and have compassion and empathy and try to support the people that had done probably things just as bad as what had happened to his daughter. So that's a pretty poignant example of forgiveness. Any thoughts about what we've said so far?
So when you're talking about him being so angry and letting go of that, I mean, isn't that just a basic form of attachment? He's so attached to the anger and holding on to the anger. And so once you don't become attached, then it's away. But you still have feelings, though.
Yeah. I mean, he was attached to his daughter.
Right.
And then the thought, I hate this guy who killed my daughter. That thought, he clung to that for decades and tortured himself with it. Rubino, and you know, she, I've asked her this subject in years past about forgiveness, and she, you know, she doesn't give it much. She doesn't spend much time on it. She says, well, the main reason you forgive, you should forgive, is because it's in your best interest to forgive. Like who suffers the most with anger and resentment? Who suffers the most? And we use example of anger and resentment. It's like reaching into a fire, you know, with burning coals, grabbing an ember and throwing it at somebody. Well, you may or may not hit them, or you may or may not harm them, but every time you get hurt, every time you do it, you suffer. Why would you do that? So these are all easy things to say, aren't they? But we all have so many, you know, people that we got it out for, that have done us wrong, you know, that we're holding on to some resentment. And maybe you go back to, I mean, I have even people that did me wrong when I was a kid, and I still, when I look in my brain, I go, I still don't like that guy for what he did. I'm still mad at him, you know. So we have a lot of work to do. And then one of the things I talked to Nick about, and I'm just throwing this out because I'm struggling with the notion of forgiveness, because I think it is something we need to open this thing up a little bit and put it in a language and try to look at it in a more in-depth way from a Buddhist perspective. But when I look at my own experience, I mean, what about purification practice? You know, I mean, I don't know how many people do Vajrasattva practice, you know, when you know what that is? I mean, it's a purification practice that we do, 100-syllable mantra. But basically what you do is you try to remember the things that you've done wrong, and then you develop the four planet powers are a crucial part of this. So you try to recollect, take refuge and, you know, generate this altruistic intention, and then you remember as best you can all the things that you have done wrong that have harmed others, particularly. If you just have the memory of it, that's one thing. But if you have an emotional charge on it, that's the one you want to really focus on. So you generate sincere regret. And then you, sometimes it's different order, but then you can do practices like do the 100-syllable mantra, and you can visualize light and nectar coming in, and as you're doing it you can visualize the negative karma of your body, sort of all that stuff being disappearing, all the physical negative karma, all the verbal negative karma, all the mental negative karma. And then when the practice is over, you try to think, and it's really important to have a feeling that, okay, now I have, getting back to what Andre said, I have let go of, you know, I'm pure. I'm no longer this deluded person who's run by my anger and all the stuff that I've done that's negative. We try to identify with our basic purity, our basic Buddha nature. And I was talking to Nick about this, and I said, it seems like purification practice is sort of like forgiving ourselves. Like forgiving ourselves. And think about that one. I mean, think of the stories that we have told ourselves about all the limiting beliefs that we have, all the things that we've done that have been harmful to others, all those memories that we hold on to that are holding us back. They're baggage. We, you know, in psychological terms, they're baggage. You know, we have, it's amazing. We've been having good turnouts on Sunday morning, but the one event that gets the biggest turnout of the year is New Year's Eve. When we do Dorje Kadra, we have these fire pits outside, and we should have more time for it, but it just doesn't work out that way. But what people are, you know, the point of the practice is to try to recollect. And everybody has little black sesame seeds, which symbolize, our negative karmic seeds. And then you imagine Dorje Kadro is this wrathful deity, Buddha figure deity. And his, you know, the fire pit is his mouth. And since he's a Buddha, in a sense, such a manifestation of a Buddha, negativity doesn't bother him at all. It just makes him happier and blissful. So we can offer Dorje Kadro our negativity. So you think, okay, every time I lied this year, and you offer it to Dorje Kadro, and you can hear these little sesame seeds go pop, 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 pop. And it's just letting go. It's just a process of letting go. Try mentally going through the thought of thinking of what we've done wrong, generating some sincere regret, and then doing the practice. And then the most important part of Dorje Kadro, which we really don't get around to doing usually because everything kind of breaks up, is to promise as much as possible to not do it again. So it's not enough to say, oh, I regret having blah, blah, blah. It's like we have to make some kind of resolve. So that's the fourth of the four planet powers, to say, look, much as I can, I'm not going to do that again. So, you know, I was talking to Nick. I said, what do you think about this? What do you think about purification practice as being kind of a way of forgiving ourselves? Because I would say that's really important. That's probably as important, maybe even more important, because purifying our negative karma, that's what's holding us down. That's what's holding us back. So, that's a crucial part of it. I'm just kind of flushing my thoughts out. But this is another thought I had about it, too. I had this experience one time of a friend that I had, for some reason, this friend really didn't like me at all. Friend became enemy, right? And this, you know, for years, I couldn't let it go. I said, I don't know what I've done to irritate this person. And so, like some years later, I call this friend up and I say, look, I am so sorry if I've ever done anything to, you know, that, but it's really eating at me that I upset you so much. And this friend said, oh, don't worry about it. You know, it's no big deal. Like, I forgive you. That helped me. That was a huge help to me to know that this person had forgiven me. So, I don't think it's a good idea to go around and tell people, well, I forgive you for the things you've done. You know, I forgive you for being a jerk. You know, I don't think that's going to go over too well. But at least, you know, I think Lama Zopa said that that we need to apologize to people. I know a little bit about the 12 steps. Lam Rim is the 12 steps, you know, just different names. But a big part of the 12 steps, you know, and they do 12 steps not just for alcoholics and drug addicts, but they do for people with all kinds of problems. These 12 steps work. And one of the crucial steps is to apologize. to people who you've done. Is that right? I mean,
make amends.
Make amends, yeah. If it seems like it's not going to create more ick, then to go and really apologize to people. So anyway, it's a juicy subject, this whole notion of forgiveness. It's not one that comes up in conversation in Tibetan Buddhist centers. Yeah.
Hello. I was just going to ask you if you have any thought about the process of maturation in forgiveness. For instance, this person where his daughter has been killed, it's kind of logical to think that he's going to feel anger at the beginning. It's kind of valid having that. I mean, in a human condition, maybe we have things to work, and maybe at a certain point we won't even need to feel anger. But it seems totally valid, his feelings, and he's 10, maybe, I don't know how the 10 years is okay or not, but the time that he took to heal that, and then he came to a nice outcome that we're teaching other Lotus people. But I think that, to me, it might be kind of unrealistic thinking that if somebody killed my daughter, I immediately will forgive the person. It will be a process of maturation, and I will arrive to that point, but it's kind of human nature, maybe not that evolved yet, but I've seen that the point is not hanging forever in that feeling and trying to see and evolve from that feeling.
Right.
But I believe that it's a valid process of maturation to understand and heal the anger and slowly to come to the true forgiveness.
Yeah. Now, what I heard in what you said was to have compassion for ourselves. I know, while we're going through this process, it is not their, for some people, it is a 20-year process. For some people, it never goes away. And for some people, it could happen like that. Could let it go like that. I was in Dharamsala, India, in the mid-80s, and when the Dalai Lama's brother, one of his younger brothers, but died, and so the Dalai Lama's youngest brother's wife, I knew her, and their whole family had gone up with His Holiness around this time, and I said, I asked her, I said, how did His Holiness take the death of his brother? I mean, how did he seem to be upset about it or whatever? And and she said, he was fine. He was okay. He was sad, but he was okay. I guess the best I can recall, he wasn't devastated. Just like he was able to, at least my interpretation was that he was able to let go of his sadness and his attachment to his brother probably a lot quicker than those of us who hadn't done the kind of work that he's done on himself, you know, like, wanting people to stay forever and don't ever leave me and stuff. But realistically, birth leads to death, and he knows that, and he meditates on that, and he thinks about it all the time, and very aware of impermanence. So, but yeah, you're right. I mean, it's not easy to do. It's not easy to let go. And having some empathy for ourselves, that the process may take some time. Not like beat yourself up because you couldn't let go.
Yeah.
Not like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Royden, did you say? Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. I just feel compelled to say, I lost my son 4 years ago. He was murdered. And I was able to have compassion for him and forgiveness for him just like that. I was surprised. I was shocked that I had that. But it just came naturally, just as breathing. I talked to Ravina about it, and she told me, she said, the reason that you're able to have that is because you've been practicing love and compassion and forgiveness for many, many eons, for many, many years. So we forget about past lives. So we may hit that point, and it may just come. However, what I have discovered, and you're absolutely right, is that there is an evolving process. yes, compassion and forgiveness came, never ever wavered, never waned. It's always there. But what I've discovered, though, is that an act of compassion and forgiveness requires a little bit more. It deepens. And so then I decided I was going to write this guy. He's been in prison for about 2 years. And I work in prisons, and I work with people who have done these terrible things that was done to my son. And so I wrote to him and let him know that I forgive him, I have compassion for him, and I would really, really be honored if he ever came to my prison. I would love to be able to teach him about compassion and forgiveness and overcoming anger. The letter I got back wasn't the response that I wanted. He's still holding on to his own belief system, still believing that he was justified in doing his act. No sense. So that really shocked me, because I also not only work with the guys, and these guys have been in for many, many years, and they're just now reaching that point where they can really begin to really feel regret, genuine regret, for what they've done. I was expecting that kind of response. I didn't get that. So then I had to question my compassion, my forgiveness. And so then I realized, no, he's a human being. It takes time for him too. Just as I'm evolving, it takes time for him too to really recognize what he's done. It's only been 4 years. He's only been in prison for 2 years. So he's got more time. So then it requires patience. You have to be patient. You can't expect a certain result and be attached to what you want. That's the ego wanting what it wants, and when the ego doesn't get what it wants, as Ravina says, then we become angry and so forth. Without having compassion and forgiveness, without being able to do that, I would have never been able to be happy. I would never be able to go out and to teach in the prisons forgiveness and compassion. I would never be able to go out and I'm asked to speak about forgiveness and compassion. I would never, ever be able to do it, because I would be wallowing in my own anger and my own feeling of just sadness and grief. Being able to let go freed me and allowed me to be happy. I get immeasurable happiness from working with these guys in prison and doing the things that I do and being here and to be with everyone. It's without... You can't measure the happiness that I get. If I was holding on to that anger, this need for revenge, I wouldn't be able to feel that. So to be able to forgive, to be able to let go, is really for us. The other person may not be able to receive it yet, but it's really for us. Yeah.
All right, every time I hear about forgiveness, I always remember in the 60s when Black men were being lynched, and the Christians were going around saying, "Forgive them, Lord, for they know not what they do." And then you took the when Malcolm X comment, and then you say, "As long as they've been doing their masters at it, so they know what they're doing." And I think about the guy that swindled all these people's money. He knew what he was doing. And I think forgiveness is kind of rough when you know the person no better than that. If somebody kills someone in a heat of passion or something, that's something else. But when somebody plans it and does it, it's hard for you to do it. I had a patient the other day, and she is getting some treatment. And we talked, and she was suicidal, actually. I said, "Well, what's causing all this thing?" And she said, "Well, she was molested." I said, "Why don't you take it to the authorities and do something about it?" She said, "Well, he's dead. The person that left her is dead, but she's still suffering, and she can't get herself to forgive this person because there's nobody to forgive, you know, she can't do it, and she's suffering." So forgiveness can only help you. It has nothing to do with the other person. The other person may come around, but it's all about you.
Yeah. Let's do a meditation. I'm going to read. This is from the front of the book. A little excerpt from the book His Holiness wrote, and he says, for forgiveness. This is, he says, I use a meditation technique called giving and taking. I make visualization and send my positive emotions like happiness and affection to others. Then another visualization, I visualize receiving their suffering and their negative emotions. So let me say that again. I make visualizations, send my positive emotions like happiness and affection to others. Then another visualization, I visualize receiving their suffering and their negative emotions. I do this every day. I pay special attention to the Chinese, especially those doing terrible things to Tibetans. So as I meditate, I breathe in all their poisons, hatred, fear, cruelty, and then I breathe out. And I let out all the good things. I let all the good things come out, things like compassion and forgiveness. I take inside my body all these bad things. Then I replace poisons with fresh air, giving and taking. I take care not to blame. I don't blame the Chinese, and I don't blame myself. This meditation is very effective and useful to reduce hatred and useful to cultivate forgiveness. So, some people think, well, I don't want to visualize taking in poison or negativity. It might make me sick. And if I was, you know, somebody asked a Tibetan Lama one time, what if I get sick? What if I really take in their negativity and get sick? And the Lama said, great, fantastic. Okay, you've been able to take their suffering and, you know, give them happiness. So, you know, don't expect a lot of, you know, help there. But just imagine that, you know, so I invite you, let's take a minute to get quiet. And we'll do a little meditation, guided meditation. And this is very, you know, this is a, I left this meditation out of this, the Cultivating Bodhicitta part, but it's called Tonglen, taking and giving. And usually it's actually giving and taking, but most of the time it's done. You take away the suffering of others and you give them happiness. And so, I'll elaborate a little bit. But start out by focusing on your breath. Bring your mind to the present moment. Now, I want you to, in your mind's eye, imagine that, you know, the people that you're close to, like ideally you have a good relationship with your parents, your mom's on your left, your dad's on your right, your family's around you and your friends. And then the people that you don't like, and particularly, and it's got to be, I want you to pick somebody that you've got. And maybe somebody from your childhood or somebody that you're still holding on to some resentment and anger toward that person. I want you to visualize that person. Now, also imagine you're surrounded by all living beings in human form, but particularly you're focusing on this one person that you have some issue with, that's done you wrong. And that you still are holding on to some resentment and anger toward. And that you want to work on forgiveness. And honestly, there may be some people you don't want to forgive, including yourself. In fact, oftentimes the teachers say, when you do Tonglen, you start with yourself. We're talking about self-forgiveness. But we're going to work with somebody else this time. So think of somebody, a real person, from your past that you're still holding on to some anger, and try to
recollect what they did and actually generate some kind of, let your mind go with it and generate that, let that mind recollect the feelings that came along with it, whatever your experience is, let that experience bubble up. They did something. They harmed me. They harmed me. They did something to me. That's the ego talking. And I'm angry about it. I resent them. That's the ego talking. Now, before we can do the taking and giving, we have to be convinced. It's not just, okay, I'm going to take on their suffering and give them happiness. That's not going to work, usually. So why should we take on their suffering? Well, let's take a look at the so-called enemy. Lama Zopa's writing a book right now using his teachings on the kindness of the enemy. Well, how is the enemy kind to me? Well, this person who we label enemy is kind to me because, well, why did they harm me in the first place? What goes around comes around. If somebody hits you with a stick, you don't get angry at the stick. You get angry at the person. Well, the person is like the stick. Shantideva, in his text, he talks about that. He says, the person who harms you is like the stick. The real source of the harm is your own self-cherishing, self-centered, egocentric mind. That's the real demon. If you want to get angry at something, get angry at your ignorance that you harbor in your heart, in your heart of hearts. That's the real demon. That person is just the instrument by which our negative karma comes back to us. And then that relationship of enemy can flip in just a second. So impermanent, it's so changeable. And then this person that we label enemy, who teaches us patience and tolerance? It's not our friends. It's the people who challenge us, who harm us. That's where we develop our inner strength, our patience and tolerance. That person that we label enemy is our ticket to enlightenment, is our ticket to supreme happiness. It's our ticket to be a perfect guide to all other beings. We have to develop, and the Bodhisattva practices, the perfection of patience and tolerance. It's one of the six perfections. Who teaches us? Who teaches us patience and tolerance? The so-called enemy. This person is our ticket to supreme happiness. And in past lives, has been as kind to us as our mother, has actually been our mother. This person wants exactly what we want, wants to be happy, doesn't want to suffer. So we use this kind of analysis, analytical thinking, to soften this label of enemy. And now we think, you know, this person has created such terrible karma for themselves. It's going to suffer immensely. And is suffering now. You know, we think like this. So we imagine in their, all their negativity in the form of black smoke kind of rising above their head. And then you imagine that you breathe in all of their negativity, of body, speech, and mind, all their negative karma. You take it right into your heart. You breathe it right into your heart. And it destroys your self-cherishing ego. And then your egocentricity is just completely liberated. And then as you breathe out, and you can think, may this person be happy and have the causes of happiness. May they have everything that they want and need. May they become supremely happy and enlightened. May they have all the good things and none of the bad things. So you work with this part, this meditation for a couple of minutes to see if you can generate some experience of letting go of your resentment and anger. And then take one last moment to make some determination to let go of anger and resentment and to cultivate forgiveness. And sometimes this practice takes a lot of courage, really. It takes a lot of courage to, because we don't want to let go. We don't want to forgive ourselves or other people sometimes. Thank you, everyone, for your contribution and sharing. That was really helpful.
So we'll finish the program with our dedications, which are in the white prayer book on the pink sheet. And I'll be reading the prayer list before we begin. Prayers for a happy rebirth. All those killed by natural and man-made disasters. All the Tibetans who have been killed or have taken their own lives in the struggle for religious freedom. The inmate who was beaten to death for being gay. Gertrude Garrett, Tina Hathis, Sarah Roberts Iller, Charles Gregory King V, Donald Mueller, Tenjiki Sherpa, Jonathan Tagle, V. Ventura, Dakini the dog, Duncan the dog, Orange Cat, Sadie the dog, and Gertrude, Elise's aunt. For job search, Eve Ahara, Beth Andrew, Jerry Kane, Daniel Cunningham, Jenny First, Michael Foltz, Kate Harvey, Andrea Johnson, Wendy King, Catherine Myers, April Rocker, Tony Sloan, Michelle Thompson, Lori Todd, S.S., Anna Dean Silver, and Sarah. Difficulties of body and or mind. Venerable Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Lama Pema Wangduk, Venerable Chikila, all those harmed by natural and man-made disasters. For the Tibetan people and for the Chinese authorities, may the nonviolent path lead to full reconciliation and religious freedom. Denise Allen, Jim Barnes, Bill Burke, Ron Burroughs and family, Hester Clifford, Allegra Delquist, Larry Davis, Carrie First, Mildred Gooch, Davis Helton, Lola Hilliard, Claude Hollyfield, Leslie and Joan Inman, Sarah Robert Iller's family, Kenny Jackson and Buddy, Andrew Johnson, Bill Johnson and family, Sugi Jones, Helen Kasanoff, Charles Gregory King's family, Kathy Kohler, Shanti and Kurt Latimer, Aunt Lori, Alyssa Luck, Carolyn and Granger Marley, Bobby Martin, Jameen Pandya, Lively Pasque, Catherine Paul, Mary Peterson, Aunt Polly, Sarah Noel Quinlan and her family, Duncan Quinn, Richard Robeson, Reuben family, Paula Sable, Rosemary Cease, Tanjiki Sherpa's family, Mamie Stark, David Underwood, Lee Ventura's family, Amy Weintraub, Claudia and Vic Williams, Suzanne Williams, Judith Wormser, Casey the dog, Chelsea the cat, Ninjay the cat, Skippy the dog. And if there's anyone else whose name you'd like to mention, please say it now. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chen Reizig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Savior of the snowland teachings and transmigratory beings, who extensively clarifies the path that unifies emptiness and compassion, to the lotus in the hand, Lord Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be fulfilled. The one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Awatare, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama, ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serves as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjanath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And then we'll do seven Tara mantras for Geshe Gelug's long life and swift return. Om tare tu re so ha. 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 Om tare tu re so ha.